Minajna jinbarranin fuq 103.7 Campus, illum għandi miegħi mistieden illi verament qed nieħu pjaċir illi ftakart fih u għamilt kuntatt miegħu għaliex verament li jista' jgħidilna huwa interessanti ħafna u għandu ħafna aktar esperjenza u ta' osservazzjoni ta' Malta u tagħna l-Maltin milli ħsibt li kellu. Dr. Gary Armstrong, I'm very happy that I remembered our conversations 20 years ago and the fact that I read some of your writings when we first met, because it turns out that you have much more to tell us than I originally thought. I had read your writings about Malta and Maltese football and Maltese society that runs around the football world. And I remember meeting you 20 years ago. I was introduced by a mutual friend, and it was a pleasure having a chat, a conversation with you. You've been coming and going from Malta for many years, and that you've actually lived here for a while. So you have much more to talk to us about than just the Maltese football scene, which was going to be my original take on our conversation. So, Dr. Gary Armstrong, it's a great pleasure to meet you again. You're here in Malta. We're at a local hotel, which you're staying at, which you like very much as well. You've stayed here many times. And it's going to be fun talking to you over the next hour, discussing Malta through international eyes. So first of all, hello, Dr. Gary Armstrong.
Hello, Mr. Colin Fitz, the Mr. DJ, if I remember you from 20 years ago. So good to see that you're still in the business. Thank you for the interview and thanks for the invite.
Indeed, 20 years ago we had met at our favorite pub run by a mutual friend, and I used to do some DJing there as well. And I used to do some writing at the time, which eventually turned into a journalism job, and now this job I do now. So first of all, Dr. Gary Armstrong, let's go back to your childhood and your journey through the educational system. Give us a little bit of background to tell us how you got where you are now.
No, I was brought up in South Yorkshire. It's a town called Rotherham. My first 9 years of my life, I was brought up in Rotherham, and then we moved over the border into Sheffield. And so the next 9 years of my childhood was Sheffield. So this was I consider it a privileged background, even though it was a working class background. My father is Irish, and an Irish labourer who came in 1953 to England and worked on building sites all his life. And my mother was various jobs, but what you might call minimum wage jobs. It was a Catholic upbringing in a working class district, but in a city that in the 60s and 70s had probably 1% unemployment because of the massive amount of work in steel and coal. So an area with a very strong work ethic, with strong unions, and with people who did things and were involved in public life. It was, like I say, a privileged upbringing.
And your educational journey?
I went to Catholic schools, which Sheffield isn't a bastion of Catholicism. And so if you were a Catholic in Sheffield, you were usually from an Irish or Italian or a Polish background. And Catholic school, comprehensive school. Then I went to De La Salle College, a school. And then for my sixth form, I went to Notre Dame. So these were nominally run by the religious order, even if the religious order only had two or three people teaching. The rest were, civilians, if you want.
And eventually you went to higher education, and what made you decide to become a, is it sociologist? Do you describe yourself as that?
Anthropology. I was not really scheduled to go to university. Perhaps somebody with my background would have been more appropriate, probably, you know, Irish, Catholic, good home. I was classic police. But anyway, I wasn't in the A stream, I was in the B stream. And in fact, for some subjects, I was in the C stream. But there was a teacher, I always remember him, Mr. Civico, who was Italian, or of Italian origin, who took a great interest in my good self for absolutely, totally honourable reasons, and suggested I apply myself to studies and I could go somewhere. And, well, the rest is history. I got enough what were called O-levels to stay on at school. Then I got fabulous grades at A-level. Then I went to a very prestigious university called University College London, where I read anthropology and history. And then I returned and took a PhD in anthropology, and for my sins had the next 40 years working in the academe.
So we're going to come to Malta in a second, but which countries have you conducted studies in apart from Malta?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, mine was a little bit unusual, my PhD, because the PhD is the passport, if you want, for jobs in academe. So my PhD was unusual in that classic anthropology was usually about going somewhere like around the global south and somewhere near the equator and catching some exotic disease and writing about pre-literate people. I actually returned home. What I mean by that is I actually studied people in Sheffield. So this was anthropology, quite revolutionary, studying your own people and studying your own culture. Now, but by the time I had graduated from my PhD passed, I then started to apply what I'd learned to Malta, which we'll get onto. I'd visited Malta years before. And then I looked at similar stuff to what I was doing in Malta in Liberia, West Africa. That was a war zone. And also Bosnia-Herzegovina. But maybe we can talk about that later.
So that would have been in the 90s?
Liberia was late 80s and noughties, and Bosnia was this millennium. And I also had a look at Italian calcio, which you can't study Italy without looking at football. You know that.
In fact, just before we talk about Malta, your relationship with football over the years.
I come from Sheffield, which, as any football fan knows, is the birthplace of association football. You know, the Sheffield rules were instrumental in the rules of football, and the oldest football club in the world, amateur football club, is Sheffield FC, founded in 1857. So I came from the city that gave the world football. It also gave the world stainless steel. And I will ask the listener to tell me which one changed the world the most.
Did you play at all? Were you involved in the sport?
Yeah, I got to a fairly good level as a teenager. I had trials, but I don't want to be that idiot at the bar telling people I could have been a contender. I wasn't good enough. I got so far, I peaked at 16. I played for a few pub teams later, but no. And then I hardly ever played again, but I kept fit. I turned to middle distance running and then swimming. And now I live in North London, so it's compulsory to do yoga.
Now, regarding football and anthropology, do most of your studies center around sport, the anthropology of sport in these societies that you study, or did you approach the study of these societies from other angles as well?
When I was at university, no one ever taught sport. If you look at a university until around 1990, sport was, it belonged in teacher training. It belonged in, you became a PE teacher and you, that was sport. It wasn't considered really respectable in the oldest universities. Then it changed. Part of the change came from like the MBAs and the business. People realized that sport was a huge economy. And so we'd better start getting people kind of conversant in the financing of sport. Then you've got media, and you know, a lot of the media relies on sport. I mean, what would Sky be without sport? But I did something unique. I was the first anthropology PhD that looked at football. And whilst there were sniggers, I'll admit there were sniggers and perhaps mild derision, that soon ended when it became the biggest selling anthropology book in Britain in 1998.
One of your books?
Yeah.
Remind us the name.
I wrote a book called Football Hooligans, Knowing the Score, which, well, the clue's in the title. And this went down very well. It won a prize and it sold very, very well. And people had to realise that football, well, think about it, what is the biggest shared cultural phenomenon on planet Earth? It's called football. And guess what? Anthropologists weren't looking at it. Since then, we've got a number of universities that offer degrees in sport and sport-related degrees. I mean, probably three quarters of the British universities offer a degree with sport in its title. But also anthropology then discovered that it was quite valid to look at something that is the most agreed upon rules on the planet.
It must have been really fascinating for you living through and observing the changes, the 70s and 80s, the football hooliganism, the whole Heysel stadium thing, and then the start of the Premiership, the change from pocket money to huge wages for players, the power of the agents. You saw all that happen in front of you and you were reporting about it.
I've kind of lived the journey. My one regret is I didn't make anything like the money that some of these very mediocre players make these days. But it got me a job. I mean, I'm quite happy to admit I got a career out of football without ruining the lawn or getting muddy. So I looked at football, but equally I got lucky. Anthropology was changing. I mean, anthropology's got a long history of working for colonial power. And it was also a subject which was very, very upper middle class. It was posh kids at posh universities. So anthropology throughout the 90s and the noughties became a little bit more open to new ideas. And I was very fortunate in that the subject, football hooliganism, coincided beautifully with the rise of a new subject, which we now take for granted, called criminology. And criminology, you couldn't do a degree in criminology until 1990. So in the 80s, there was a few places did criminology as a master's, but it mostly quantitative stuff, you know, like number crunching, how many this and how many that. I was fortunate to be able to put the techniques of anthropology, in particular, something called ethnography, in a sense, going along the journey, seeing, getting down and dirty, with criminology, which became the subject in Britain for the next 30 years. I think 88 universities now teach criminology, but I was able to put on only the second undergrad degree in criminology in 1991. It's a hugely popular subject.
How many books have you published?
That's a good question. And I'm going to be a little bit evasive because If somebody asked me how many books have got my name on the cover, I think it's 14 or 15. So there's some where I am the sole author, others where I am joint author, others where I am the editor of a collection. So publishing is never quite straightforward.
So the name is Dr. Gary Armstrong. Do your research. I guarantee you'll have a very interesting read, particularly if you're interested in anthropology or the subjects that Dr. Armstrong has mentioned to us, and of course, football, and football in society. Now, we'll take a little break. Let's listen to some music. And I'm not sure I told you to prepare a song. I did, didn't I? So let me see. You're from Sheffield, the Sheffield area, so we're going to hear the Human League.
Well, where do I start? I was living in Sheffield in the early 80s when it may not be too much of an exaggeration to say it was the most interesting musical city on earth. You've got your classic balladeers like Tony Christie and Joe Cocker, and then you'd got incredible innovative sounds from ABC, remember them? Yeah. Def Leppard. The Human League, and there was a whole lot more. I mean, Sheffield was a hell of an exciting place.
Heaven 17?
Oh, God, I forgot. Yeah. Heaven 17, yes, indeed. And we were spoilt to death. You know, it was a great musical scene. But the record I chose is one which is totally connected to football, but has got nothing to do with Sheffield. It's still one of the great songs from country music, and it was a song which was a favourite of the public announcer before every match at Sheffield United. As we streamed into the ground an hour before kickoff, he'd start the music with this wonderful track by somebody called Lynn Anderson, and it was called Rose Garden. And like I say, one of the all-time wonderful country music, and one of the few pop records to have melancholy in the lyrics.
I beg your pardon, I never promised you a rose garden. Along with the sunshine, there's gotta be a little rain sometimes. When you take, you gotta give. So live, or let go. Oh, 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 I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden. I could promise you things like big diamond rings, but you don't find roses growing on stalks of clover. Pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometime. I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden. I could sing you tune and promise you the moon, but if that's what it takes to hold you, I'd just as soon let you go. But there's one thing I want you to know. You better look before you leap. Still waters run deep, and there won't always be someone there to pull you out. And you know what I'm talking about. So pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometime. I beg your pardon.
I'm talking to Dr. Gary Armstrong on this program, Minainein Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes, here on campus 103.7. Dr. Gary Armstrong is an academic who has studied anthropology, football anthropology around the world, including here in Malta. And now, in fact, it's time to talk about Gary's relationship with Malta, which goes far beyond sports anthropology, football anthropology, as I originally thought, because he's been visiting here for many, many years and actually lived here for a while. But I'll leave him to tell us about his very first visit to Malta and why it was made.
Very good question. I arrived, I always remember it, September the 12th, 1979. And it was the first time I'd ever been abroad. It was the first time I'd ever been on an aeroplane. And you're probably going to ask, why the hell did I choose Malta? Well, in a sense, Malta chose me. And it goes back to an institution in Slema called the Salesians of Don Bosco. And to cut a long story short, I was considering the priesthood, and one of my great friends from Sheffield was a priest already out in Malta called the Reverend Tony Frayne. And if there's any regulars or any listeners out there, you'll always remember Tony, because he was the first one, I believe, in Malta to almost subvert the Catholic Mass, because he used to come onto the altar and say good morning. And I think this kind of stunned some of the very polite people of Slema in its informality. Anyway, that's another story. So I came to Malta for a year. This was between finishing high school, you know, sixth form, and was I going to go to university or was I going to go to seminary? Well, it wasn't probably the best idea to put me in a religious institution 100 metres from the beach. And I kind of walked along Quisisana, Tinya Point and Exiles and realised I wasn't going to be a priest. But they let me stay anyway. So I worked for a year as a teacher in St. Patrick's School.
That particular year, 79-80, was a very important year in Malta. We had just had our what's called the Freedom Day, the 31st of March, the end of the British base in Malta. It was also a bit of a politically charged era in Malta. Do you have any memories of that aspect of Maltese culture at the time?
No, indeed. This was a hell of an awakening to somebody who had never really left Sheffield. I arrived and everybody, you know, walking around quite innocently, everybody thought I was a squaddie, a soldier. Because I'm 6 foot, I was fit, short hair. You know, possibly they thought the one who'd missed the boat or something like that. So there was still a great interest in from indigenous people about, you know, Brits. But it was. I stayed a year, and in that year, I realised that there were problems. I remember in October, I'd only been here a month, an advert in the Times of Malta saying, there's a rally. I'd never, ever been to a political rally. And I thought, you know, this sounds interesting, and I'm not doing anything. And I actually went to watch, not participate, to watch the Labour Party rally, which ended with the sacking of the Times of and the Courier. I was there.
The burning down of the Times at the time. Oh, goodness me, okay.
So, and you know, I remember coming home to St. Patrick thinking, wow, this is something I've never experienced. This is strong stuff. And in the course of the year, I remember we had no water frequently in the institution, and we were reliant at many times on bowsers. Remember these big lorries that brought water? Mm-hmm. And at times, living in St. Patrick's, were about 150 boys. And to wash, we had to go down to Exiles and jump in the sea.
Gosh.
I remember power cuts, electric power cuts. I met Laurie Sant. I met Archbishop Gonzi. They visited the institution of St. Patrick's. And I met the wife of Don Mintoff. I didn't meet Mintoff himself, but there was an immersion. My immersion was very innocent. I was kind of dinner table talk about be careful, you're an outsider, the Catholic Church is under threat. The Blue Nuns were packed off on an aeroplane one night, and so there was quite an apprehension. I think I use the word apprehension more than fear.
But you were told to stay one step back, not to express opinions and things.
Yes, it was like, who knows?
By the people around you, though, not because you mentioned, for example, Laurie Sant. You weren't. Were you threatened, or are you saying that people told you to not express opinions?
It was the latter. I don't think anybody knew the lie of the land or how this was going to end, and so it was like, be careful what you say. Don't get involved in anything controversial, do the teaching, be civil, and don't do anything which might be considered an overt display of British colonialism.
What an interesting time. There were British, it was quite turbulent in British political history as well at the time, wasn't it? The rise of Margaret Thatcher, the 70s weren't a particularly fantastic period for lots of unemployment in Britain, lots of strikes. Could you make a comparison between the situation here and the situation in Malta from what you remember? Is that possible?
Well, I mean, I came from the city, which it was the first city to ever elect a Labour administration in 1906. It was a solid Labour town. And it was the town that Margaret Thatcher hated. She hated Sheffield. And we got it in the neck. So when she came to power, the city council didn't help the cause, because I think they thought Thatcher was a flash in the pan. She'd be gone in 3 or 4 years. So they do things like declare themselves the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire. And then when the royal wedding of Charles and Diana, they put a red flag on top of the town hall instead of the Union flag. And, you know, guess what? Government investment didn't exactly flow into Sheffield. And then that's when the big industrial trouble. We had first the steel strike. And the steel strike of 1881, this saw mass closures, mass redundancies of steel production. And then a few years later came the defining moment of late 20th century Labour history with the miners' strike, of which, my district was one of the epicentres of the miners' strike. This was a place called Orgreave. And I was at Orgreave. I wasn't a miner, but I was at the event, and it changed forever.
And if anybody wants to understand Britain in the early 80s, they have to read about that miners' strike and all the stories around it. So the one-year trip to Malta came to an end. Could you tell us a little bit about how that concluded, and then when was the next time you came to Malta?
Yeah, it concluded well. I wasn't going to be a priest, but I was going to go to university. So I went more or less from Malta to London. Oh, that was one hell of a contrast. Then, when would I go back to Malta? Well, every summer. I went back and I worked for a couple of summers in the school, in the Salesian school, because they were short of staff. And then from 83 to 87... I used to, in a sense, summer out here working for NSTS. It was then primarily Italians
The student agency that would bring foreign students to Malta to learn English and also, you know, practice water sports and have a little holiday in Malta. And also, yes, Maltese students would benefit from the international student card, which they provided. And STS, many fond memories of that organization. They were based in Tinier, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was like you got deployed wherever. I mean, I was teaching at the university because they hired rooms there. I was teaching at Stella Maris College. Mm-hmm. I'd teach anywhere. I mean, and it was a wonderful time meeting, well, you know, somebody from Sheffield meeting some of the most beautiful people on earth.
Yes, of course, there was tourism was on the rise, lots of British tourists coming to Malta. In fact, I wanted to ask you, before you came to Malta in 79 to work at Salesians and also perhaps go to the seminary, when was the first time you had heard of Malta? Did Malta figure in your childhood or when you were growing up? Did you know Malta existed?
Yeah, there was two things I remember well. One, there was this famous TV program called Wicker's World, and there was this, looking back, quite a strange man called Alan Wicker, who used to go around doing a sort of travel log diary. And one year in the early 70s, he went to Malta, and I remember watching this. He wasn't that complimentary, because he did talk about the smell of sewage on the beaches, or a particular beach. And the other one I remember, because it was so unusual, was when England played, I think it was a World Cup qualifier, or it might have been a European Cup qualifier against Malta, 1-1-0. And we were watching in black and white a football ground with compacted sand, yeah, and with football posts painted, I think, red and black.
Yes, the Empire Stadium in Gzira. It's actually still there, but not used for football anymore. Very overgrown, but it was where all major football was played in Malta. Yes.
No, you'd think, God, this place, Malta. Where's Malta? And that was it. And if you want, in the psyche of someone like myself, Malta was sunshine, a little bit unusual because it didn't have grass and. And beware of certain beaches.
Fantastic. Then, as the 80s marched along, you'd come here every year. And when did you start writing about Malta and studying the football situation here?
Well, I got a job in academe by the late 80s, 90s, and then part of academia is you teach, they call it lecturing and teaching, it's the same damn thing. But then you have to justify yourself when not teaching by producing articles and books. And I got into a great interest in local football in Malta and thought, well, no one's writing from an anthropological angle. They've got some great writers like Carmel Baldacchino is an excellent historian and archivist and commentator on local football, but I thought, no, there's a book here, because okay, as I always told my students, if I came to Malta and a tourist said, show me Malta, I always had this, call it a prejudice if you want, that if you wanted to see Malta, you saw it through the prism or the window, whichever you want to use, of sport. And I said, real Malta isn't the Mediterranean Conference Centre and isn't recreations of battles. It was regatta. It was bocce. It was trotting up in the north. And it was football.
And the horses, yeah, trotting.
Oh, yes. That was real Malta. And real Malta was the football and the domestic leagues, and not just the domestic leagues, it was the foreign fan clubs. You know, the obsession this island has with either an English club or an Italian club. And it was also, on one level, the questions around the national team, which brought big questions about national identity.
This is interesting. I totally understand that you're approaching Malta via sport from an anthropological perspective, but the fact that a British person is interested in local Maltese football, when most of the time, even from locals, many locals put down Maltese football and joke about it, because their main aim is to support foreign teams, and I'm not judging here, that's just the way it is. We're a small country, it probably happens in other small countries as well, where people from a small football nation support bigger teams outside of their borders. But what I'm saying here is that usually, even on television, you get the occasional dismissive comment about, oh, these small teams, why does England have to play against them? It's a risk for our players to play against these amateurs. In the 70s, I think the Maltese players were dismissed as waiters or fishermen. And then there was even Rafael Benitez a year or so ago, we're recording in 2024, I think he said something like, oh, when we play against teams like Malta, you can play with a cigarette in your hand, or I can coach with a cigarette in my hand. These kind of dismissive comments, which are hurtful, and they don't keep in mind the fact that teams like Iceland, which used to be a small nation in the 70s, Malta used to beat Iceland, eventually, for a period, became quite a strong team and even beat England. So maybe one day in our dreams, Malta can get to that level as well. So it's not really fair to be judged in that way. On the other hand, Malta has consistently been quite bad in international football. Even I have to admit that. So my point is, it's interesting to see a British person take so much interest in Maltese football, including the domestic league, which is often described as slow and boring, and yet you do it with so much love and attention.
Well, it started with I was always very interested in the origins of football clubs, and you've got a huge interest in, you know, you've got the Irish, Floriana, yeah. And, you know, who founded Sliema and who founded Valletta. And so in a sense, the origin of the species was always interesting. The other one there was, you know, I was always interested in the antagonisms that football could bring.
And not just in Malta, in general, you mean?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you've got this incredible kind of parochialism, you know, that you could absolutely loathe somewhere a kilometre away, and you know all that. The Maltese, I'm going to mispronounce this, but you know, Tmiek. The enjoyment of watching others fail, you know, the kind of
Il Pica, maybe the peak Pica. Okay, let's see.
And that, from an anthropological point of view, that was fascinating. But equally, I loved the music. There was great music attached, kind of appropriated from the bands and the festas and put into the football grounds. So the music was great. And then it also got very interested in terms of migration. So you've got epochs of migration. So in the 70s, it was kind of the elephant's graveyard, the last payday for British players, and then it got interesting with Bulgarian players. And
are you talking about people like Paul Mariner, for example?
Yeah, and there's Latchford, Mariner, I mean a whole host of Talbot, a whole host of players came out here for the last payday. And then it changed, often to do with the wider political circumstance. When Malta looked for friends outside of its former colony, you know, it went to the Eastern Bloc, and that's when you got a friendship with Bulgaria. Yeah. And then later again, you've got Italians, Albanians, Greeks, and then around the new millennium, it became a stop-off point for many African players who were hoping to be sold on, and no doubt their agents were as well, to Western Europe. So there was a kind of political economy, as well as a sort of curious folklore economy attached to football.
That's absolutely true. So it must be very interesting to see it in such a compact, for want of a better word, market or area. It makes it ideal for an anthropologist like you to study it.
Mm. Well, the other one there was the intrigue. I'm going to use the word intrigue. How do you win the league in Malta? And this is where, let me qualify this straight away. How do you win the league anywhere? in the world, and Malta is not unique in this. The incredible intrigue that people got involved in, and I always think it was like when I was in Liberia, clubs would visit the juju man, or they would, in some instances, sleep in a church. The team would sleep in a church the night before because they believed that God-given powers would go with them into the stadium the next day. So it was, this is meat and drink to anthropologists, the idea of whom can you call on, be it economics, politics, clientelism, or straightforward corruption, or God, to win a game, you know, and especially when everybody's doing the same thing.
And then there's also the political element. I've read local books, local anthropologists have written about the rise of the Maltese village band, hand in hand with the allegiance to a local political party. And I would assume football clubs went through the same phases, went through the same process, didn't they?
Well, the football was never quite obvious red or blue. Look, if you were Sleema Wanderers, your patron was more than likely to be a nationalist. Mm-hmm. And if you were Hibernians in Paola, you were going to be favoured by Labour. But, you know, what you've got there, though, is some very, very interesting post-colonial movements of the provision of sporting arenas by the Ministry of Public Works, if I remember right. Laurie Sant built bocce pitches throughout Malta. They upgraded former colonial
facilities
for the Maltese. Yeah. They built the national stadium. So sport was part of the project of post-colonialism, and particularly Laurie Sant and Don Mintoff.
We'll take a little break and listen to the second song chosen by Dr. Gary Armstrong, my guest on Minainain Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes, here on Campus 103.7. We enjoyed Rose Garden by Lynn Anderson earlier on. What's our second choice?
It's Off the Wall by Michael Jackson. And this is when a sound which basically in 1979, when I arrived in Malta, there were three songs that you could not avoid anywhere on the island. There was Brick in the Wall.
Pink Floyd.
And then there was Street Life by Randy Crawford. But this one takes me back, and here I am at 64. I'm in Dewdrops. I'm in Patchville. And I'm watching all these gorgeous people move around, and I'm wondering if I'm going to be a priest. Anyway, perhaps Michael Jackson helped me decide it wasn't for me. And this is one of the great, great albums from one of the most astonishing artists of the 20th century.
Enjoy yourself.
living off the wall.
Fantastic choice, and it's nice that you made a reference to Malta in 79-80 when you were here for that year, and these were songs that would be played all the time in nightclubs and on the beach and maybe even on the radio. So a taste of Malta musically in those days as well. Back to your studies and your love of football and Malta. What else can you tell us about your observations of the Maltese football and Maltese society? For example, the national team. We mentioned the national team earlier. You were around just before the Big 12 won, lost to Spain, for example. Through your studies, what have you heard about the rumors about, you know, money exchanging hands and the reasons why maybe the multinational team, the men's national team, by the way, because the women are doing quite well, funnily enough, better than the men, let's put it this way, in recent years. So kudos to them. But the men's national team, we've just had another bit of a slap in the face. San Marino, who we always beat, and they're meant to be one of the worst teams in the world, yet they were handed a very easy group in the Nations League, and they went up to League C, something which we have never managed to do. We're still stuck in League D. So the national team always seems to make one step forward and two steps back over the years. What are your thoughts?
I mean, if only I had the answer to this. I mean, this did fascinate me, and because you've got places with a population far lower than Malta, like Iceland, but Iceland are a very respected national team. And if I looked at the Bundesliga and the English leagues, you could fill perhaps 22 positions in Iceland with players playing in those leagues. Malta, this brings in big questions about national identity, doesn't it? That, you know, were people too involved in the villages and the village football clubs? Were too many people involved in pursuing education and the professions to the detriment of playing sport? Because one could say, as a parent, where's the end product in putting so many hours into sport when there wasn't much money in it? It was still kind of voluntary. And, you know, now, of course, you know, a parent would look at a promising child and say, quick, get this child to England or Germany, quick, and, you know, we could be on £100,000 a week. So there was a, where is sport in the Maltese psyche? Then was the progress of a player hampered by an obsession with beat in Valletta to the detriment of that player's development in national identity. Then, of course, there was a big problem of whose national identity this is. Is it the nationalists or is it Labour? Then what investment are you putting into football? Which, again, that answers itself, because Malta at one time would be the only country in possibly in the world that was training full-time together 5 times a week. But they still couldn't make that leap.
Yes, this was a period in the 80s and 90s. Mm.
So perhaps the short answer was that Malta should have taken its talent and told these young players, maybe in their mid-teens, you are going to England, Germany, France. And yes, it's going to be unpleasant. But who wants to leave Malta?
Yes, absolutely. The family element and living with, being spoiled by parents, being spoiled by Nana and Nanno. I think that's very hard to leave behind sometimes. Also, being a big fish in a small pond, as opposed to being all alone in a flat somewhere while you're making the hard slog up the ladder in a big city abroad.
No, absolutely. You know, look, the road to stardom, the road to fabulous wealth and fame in football, if only people knew the dedication and the misery and the tears that these players go through to get where they are today. I've got a nice little story, really, because a couple of years ago, I know somebody who made the reverse. Had a promising youth with Arsenal, didn't make it, but played in Wales, Sweden, and ended up coming to Malta for 6 months. And that was my son, Lenny Armstrong, who had 6 months with Mostar. But it was 6 months in a shared house with five others, living a bit hand-to-mouth. If you're prepared to do that, you will make it. But so few footballers across the world are prepared to do that. And the Maltese, understandably, as I celebrate 45 years on this island, who wants to leave?
Someone should do a study, maybe you or somebody who will come after you. It seems like a lot of the female national team players are making it abroad. They go to different teams and they manage to stay for years playing abroad. But it's most of the boys seem to have not managed to make. A few have, the Michael Mifsuds, the Andres Kembris. But many go for a few months and there's talk in the newspapers, oh, he's about to sign with that team or that. And very shortly afterwards, they're back playing in the Maltese League. But there are four or five Maltese girls who have been abroad for years and they've even made it to quite big name teams. So that's a very interesting phenomenon which should be studied, I think. But perhaps we've spoken too much about football. No, but let's move on from football and come back to your relationship with Malta to conclude this very interesting program. Gary Armstrong, Dr. Gary Armstrong, coming and going from Malta, even having lived here for a year. But so how often do you still come to Malta? And do you come here to do work or do you come here to relax or both?
Short answer is both. In the turn of the in the mid-90s, late 90s and the millennium, I did have something like 6 years teaching a couple of modules at the University of Malta. I was invited by the late, great Dr. Paul Clough. We put on a couple of modules and I came twice a year. Since then, I've come more in a tourist stroke relaxing capacity. My wife, thankfully, loves Malta as much as I do. So, and I've got friends here. So I come on average about 3 times a year. Recently, I've been coming because my university, I work for City St. George's, University of London, and they wanted to try and establish some links with the University of Malta. So I'm involved in that now, which sees me, you know, chatting with colleagues in anthropology and criminology. But I also am 64, and I always had great ambitions to retire in Malta until there was a vote, which I didn't win. The Brexit vote kind of messed that plan up. I was going to retire in Malta. Still might.
There should be a scheme to give people like you honorary residence or something because of all the good work you've done in fostering relations between our two countries.
Well, if you know anybody who can provide a passport, I will crawl to receive that that great honour. I'll tell you now, not many people know this, Colin, but in my will, I will be cremated, and I've asked for my ashes to be scattered at the Upper Baraka Gardens. I still think it's the most beautiful view in Europe, and that will be my final resting place.
Well, that's a wonderful way to conclude this interview with Dr. Gary Armstrong. And it's so nice to meet people like you who see Malta through their foreign eyes, and yet they love this country, sometimes even more than some of us do, some of us locals do. That's just beautiful to hear. Dr. Gary Armstrong, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and I urge our listeners here on Campus 103.7 to do a bit of Googling Dr. Gary Armstrong and Malta in the search window, and I'm sure a lot of your writings will come up, and information about the books you've published, and you can find out more about what Dr. Armstrong has written about Malta over the years, particularly in the field of football anthropology. Dr. Armstrong, thank you so much.
Thank you, Colin, and all the best for the future. Cheers.
We'll be right back.